Hello there, fellow traveller, and welcome to the Isms and Schisms podcast as we continue our trek to Jerusalem. Or really start it, because the People's Crusade, which we looked at last week, doesn't really count. So won't you take up your cross in the name of Christ, Crucisignatus, signed with the cross, don your heavy armour, mount your steed, and let us march together to conquer the holy lands. God wills it. We shall converge on the ancient eastern capital of Constantinople, and then shall conquer all the lands from there to Temple Mount, retaking Nicaea, the birthplace of our beloved Nicene Creed, and Antioch, where the Gentiles first converted to Christianity. We'll cross the mountainous deserts with ease. Surely, right? Surely no more than a couple of months. And surely those Seljuk Turks won't have poisoned the wells? Right? We'll certainly have an abundance of fresh water and supplies. Those Turks will fall easily and run away at the first sight of our great and righteous army. There's no way they'll dig in and make our task difficult. The pious, God-fearing folk of Jerusalem shall fling open the gates and welcome us home. Are you with me? Onward to glory and grace. Welcome to this second part on the Crusades. Last week we looked at the origins and the causes for the call to crusade, and we met Peter the Hermit, who led the people's crusade to their demise and set the real crusaders up for a difficult start. I'd suggest going back and listening to that episode before this one to get a fuller sense of the story so far. And don't worry, Peter returns in this episode. Where that initial ragged army and the disastrous attempt to get to Jerusalem, to barely get beyond Christian lands, was known as the People's Crusade, or the Peasants' Crusade, the real First Crusade, though they didn't know it would be the First Crusade at that point, is known as the Prince's Crusade, because it was led by, well, princes. The rulers and lords of Europe mustered their armies in response to the Pope's call to crusade, and they converged on Constantinople between November 1096 and June 1097. Six large armies came from France, Lorraine, Flanders, Normandy, Provence, and Italy. This crusading force was led by the Pope's representative, Adhemar, the Bishop of Puy-en-Velay, though Count Raymond of Toulouse was the main military and strategic leader. However, there was no single general, because they essentially functioned as separate armies, just with the same goal. In Constantinople, they had to pay fealty to Alexius Komnenos, the emperor of the Byzantine Empire, which they did begrudgingly, but they were given everything they needed until it was time to march on, which they did in June 1097, a combined force of approximately 100,000. The first major battle was at Nicaea, the capital of the Turks, or the Sultanate of Rum, to be more precise. Nicaea had an ancient Christian heritage, but was captured by the Turks 16 years earlier. One good thing that came from the People's Crusade was that the Seljuk Turks believed these Christian Europeans would be easy to defeat. This was not the case. The People's Crusade was nowhere near as well-trained, commanded, or resourced as the real European force. So the Turks got a little bit complacent. They underestimated the actual Crusader army, so much so that the Sultan, the ruler of the Seljuk Turks, went east to fight in a completely different battle, assuming the force he left behind could defend the city. Godfrey of Boulogne, Bohemond of Taranto and his nephew Tancred, Raymond of Toulouse and Robert of Flanders marched on Antioch, joined by Peter the Hermit, of course, and a small Byzantine force. Under siege from a much larger enemy than expected, the Turks called for a return of their Sultan, but the Crusaders defeated the returning Sultan in open battle, who retreated back east, leaving Nicaea to the Crusaders. Nicaea was next to a lake, so the Turks were able to continue supplying Nicaea by boat. So Alexius had ships wheeled over the land to secure the lake. Secretly, Alexius sent a diplomat to negotiate a surrender from the Turks without the Crusaders' knowledge. The Turks within Nicaea did surrender on the 19th of June. And when the Crusaders learnt of this little deal, they were furious because they wanted to plunder the city. Worried about all this pillaging, Alexius instructed his diplomat to get into the city first with a Byzantine army and only let a small number of Crusaders in at a time. Alexius tried to appease the Crusaders with gifts, but they felt they could have had more were they allowed to pillage and plunder, just like Jesus would have done. Nevertheless, morale was high. This victory filled the Crusaders with a sense of purpose and belief that God was with them. They were excited and believed they would arrive at Jerusalem in 5 weeks. Their estimates were off by 2 years. The main force left about a month later to march across Asia Minor. They did not anticipate just how difficult this would be. Asia Minor, modern Turkey, is quite a mountainous and rocky region, and so the main road was quite windy and included difficult climbs. But it was also the middle of summer, and it was hot. There also wasn't much food or water going around, and there were long stretches of land that were entirely desolate. The quick-moving Turks on their fast cavalry were able to traverse this land quite easily. But not the Crusaders in their heavy armor that turned into ovens in the hot sun. The main and most devastating weapon in the Turkish arsenal were their mounted archers. They were quick and agile, not weighed down with heavy armor and weapons. What they would do was that horsemen would rush to the front, firing as many arrows as they could, and then immediately retreat to make space for the next load of horsemen. So it was an almost constant barrage of arrows. And they would come in waves, rushing in for a quick attack and then retreating and then rushing back in. They knew the terrain much better than the Crusaders, so they were devastatingly effective. But they were spread out and not necessarily unified, whereas the Crusaders were many, so they managed to push onwards. The Sultan gathered his forces together to try to set an ambush. They waited for the Crusaders to pass through a valley by the city of Dorylaeum. As the Crusaders marched through, the Turks fell upon them, sweeping down the hills. But the Crusaders were well-trained and disciplined and, despite being surrounded and in a difficult defensive position, managed to hold off. They were committed to their holy cause, and should they die, they would become martyrs. Reinforcements did eventually arrive, surprising the Turks, and the tide turned in the Crusaders' favour. The Turks panicked and fled. The next stretch was skirting the Anatolian desert and mountains, and it was tough. There was no water and no shade. The Turks had destroyed the wells. The horses started to die, so many of the knights were forced to go on foot. Peter the Hermit had previously been to Jerusalem prior to the start of the Crusades, so he generally knew the way and helped lead the procession. He also preached regularly, trying to inspire them on as holy pilgrims protected by God. Supposedly, he had received a vision from Jesus when he was last in Jerusalem, asking him to preach the need for the crusade. So among the troops, he sort of took on a bit of a mythic status. Meanwhile, Godfrey's brother Baldwin started arguing with one of the other leaders, Tancred from Italy, mainly because Tancred wanted to attack the city Tarsus, but Baldwin forced him to move on. This caused a conflict between them that they never really resolved. So Baldwin thought, "I'm out of here," and took a couple of Armenian cities, and the local people welcomed him. He became the Count of Edessa and married a local aristocratic woman named Arda. But it actually proved to be a very strategic move because Baldwin was able to supply the main force with food and defend them from opposing forces from the east. The main force eventually arrived at Antioch in October, which they then put under siege. This siege was probably the most difficult endeavor of the First Crusade and possibly the most pivotal. Strategically, Antioch was vital for both the Christians and the Muslims. And it took about a year before the city fell to the Crusaders. It was a heavily fortified city, and the Turks within Antioch had more supplies than the Crusaders. Plus, the city was so large that the Crusaders were not able to fully encircle it, making it possible for the city to be resupplied. So they could essentially sit pretty and wait for the Crusaders to die from starvation, which they did in the thousands. The Bishop Adhemar believed that this was due to their sin or lack of conviction, because everyone knows that it's not the lack of food or water which causes starvation, but the sin. So the women were kicked out of the camp because of all of the seconds the Crusaders wasted with them instead of praying. And then they spent a lot of time praying. And then many started deserting, perhaps wondering where all the women went. Eventually, a Christian within Antioch opened the gates to the Crusaders, who cried, "God wills it," as they flooded into the city. The Turkish defenders hid out in the citadel for 4 days until the Turkish army arrived and put the city under siege. So the Crusaders had managed to take the city, but were now the ones being besieged by the Turks in Antioch, with some of the Turks still inside the citadel. And things were not going well for the Crusaders. That is, until someone had a very conveniently timed vision. A priest by the name of Peter Bartholomew received a vision from Saint Andrew, Jesus' brother, who led them to the location of the Holy Lance, supposedly the spear that pierced Christ's side on the cross. Now, Adhemar was suspicious because he had seen that very same relic back in Constantinople, but he went along with it for the good of the troops. Holy relics is not something I've really discussed on this podcast, but is a relatively big part of medieval Christian spirituality. It would take too long here to give them a full, proper treatment because I don't want to trivialize this idea of relics. They're basically objects that have religious significance and are sometimes understood to have a sort of spiritual power connected to them. They've been imbued with a holy or even sacramental blessing of sorts. Bones of saints are often venerated. The supposed piece of material that Jesus was buried in, known as the Shroud of Turin, is similarly venerated. Pieces of stone taken from sacred sites, or paintings or statues of Mary or other significant figures occasionally connected to miracles. Relics are still significant within Catholic and Orthodox traditions, particularly the more conservative ones, but had much greater significance in the medieval era. And while I don't necessarily agree with the practice, I still think we should treat the practice with respect. I don't want to call it magic or superstition, even though it kind of does seem like there is a bit of superstition connected to it, to be honest. Praying to or touching a skeleton is probably not going to do anything in my mind, but that's a modern perspective. For medieval Christians, relics were extremely significant. So this seriously reinvigorated the Crusades, boosting their morale into the stratosphere. Peter the Hermit preached to them, motivating them and whipping them up into a frenzy. They were outnumbered, stuck within the walls of Antioch, but when they opened the gates and rushed at the Turks, their frenzied state terrified their foes, and the Turkish army broke and ran, leaving all their stuff with the Crusaders, including a whole lot of women. Chroniclers spoke of how well-mannered Crusaders were, saying, "We did nothing evil to them, but simply speared them through." Oh. They actually just went around and stabbed everyone. But that's actually, comparatively, better than what is to come. Adhemar had died during the siege when a plague broke out, leaving the crusading force without a central leader. So after a bit of a tussle, Godfrey of Bouillon became the new leader. But there were fewer horses and depleted supplies, and the Muslim locals refused to give them provisions. A force led by Raymond attacked a smaller city called Ma'ara in their search for food. They massacred the inhabitants. However, there was not enough food still to go around. But there were fresh bodies. Human bodies. So some of the crusaders resorted to cannibalism. The accounts written by the soldiers of this moment are quite disturbing. I've not shied away from disturbing stuff in this podcast, but I am in this instance. I'll just say that there were a lot of creative attempts at making their meals more palatable. And I'll leave it at that. Despite depleted armies, they still saw themselves under the special care of God. So they were still full of hope and flesh. They stayed in northern Syria until 1099, living off the land and pillaging. And then they marched to Jerusalem, taking theologically significant regions as they went, such as Bethlehem. This final leg was much easier than Antioch, but not without its challenges. Raymond walked the length from Ma'ara to Jerusalem barefoot and in the garb of a penitent pilgrim, which just further demonstrates the spiritual significance of their cause. The locals preferred to work with the crusaders rather than fighting them, so the trek wasn't too bad. And along the way, they experienced miracles and saw visions such as Jesus and Mary. They laid siege to the city of Acre, but couldn't get the job done and decided it was too much effort, so they moved on. They took advantage of local squabbles and division among the Muslims. Jerusalem was not defended by Turks, but by Egyptians. The Fatimids had conquered Jerusalem around the same time that the Crusades were in Antioch. These Egyptians entered into negotiation with the Crusaders, offering free passage and good treatment to all Christian pilgrims if the Crusaders did not enter their territory. This was rejected. In Tripoli, just north of Jerusalem, the ruler promised to convert to Christianity if the Crusaders defeated the Fatimids in Jerusalem, and so he supplied them with horses and resources. They reached Jerusalem on the 7th of June, and they wept upon seeing the city. The farms surrounding Jerusalem had been destroyed and the wells were poisoned, so the crusaders struggled to get enough supplies. Again, they were few in number, low on supplies, tired and ragged and vulnerable to attack, so they couldn't afford a long siege. And then the crusaders received news of a large army heading their way, and they were defenseless, so they didn't have much choice but to either retreat or to attack the city. And the idea of retreating was just a foreign alien concept at this point. They stripped timber from their ships to create siege weapons and ladders, and then a priest received a vision from Adama, who told them to fast and to pray and to march around the city barefoot, like the Battle of Jericho. They did this, led by our good friend Peter the Hermit, before attacking the walls. I'm no military strategist, but fasting before a major battle doesn't seem like the best idea to me, but it nevertheless gave them the morale boost that they needed. The final assault only took a couple of days because one crusader managed to climb the walls and get a bit of a foothold inside, allowing other crusaders to enter. On the 15th of July, 1099, Jerusalem fell under the control of the Crusaders. The ensuing massacre was particularly heinous, even by 11th century standards, and shocked the Jews and Muslims. However, it was viewed approvingly by the Christians in apocalyptic terms, who gloried in their victory over the heathens.
Huzzah!
The vast majority of the defenders were killed or enslaved. Women were raped, and infants were thrown against the walls. Many of the Jews took refuge within the synagogue, So the Crusaders locked them in and set it on fire. Some of the defenders fled to Temple Mount and took refuge in the mosque. The Crusader leader, Tancred, promised them protection, but then slaughtered them the next day. At the Porch of Solomon, blood covered the floor so deep that people and horses had to wade through it as if they were wading through a river. The Crusaders then held a special worship service at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. Approximately 100,000 Crusaders left for Jerusalem. 14,000 made it, and then only a few hundred stuck around to actually defend it. Godfrey was made protector of the Holy Sepulchre. Baldwin became king of Jerusalem. Bohemond became prince of Antioch, and Raymond became count of Tripoli, after refusing the crown, claiming that only Jesus could be king of Jerusalem. What happened to Peter? We don't really know. He went back to Europe somewhere, though he might have founded a church in France and lived out his days in peace. There is also a legend that he was the first to use the rosary. There's so much to unpack and explore in this account, and whole books have been written on this topic. Personally, I find it fascinating just how spiritual the whole endeavor was. This wasn't a war or an invasion or anything like that. It was a pilgrimage. It was a divine mandate to return the holy lands to God's special chosen people, away from the Muslims who the Christians believed were tainting the place. By the time they actually arrived at Jerusalem, they were running on fumes and obsession, pushed along by a single-minded dedication to their convictions. At no point did the key leaders think it was futile. They didn't think they were going to accomplish their spiritual goal. They knew it. With every fiber of their being, they believed they just could not fail. But the other obvious ethical issue here has to do with violence. The early Christian movement had been a strictly pacifist movement, refusing to take up arms for the Roman Empire. This pacifism had them branded as weirdos, even traitors. But then following Constantine's conversion, suddenly Christians were tasked with keeping the empire safe. And so Christians had to grapple with the ethical question of violence. Theologians like Augustine developed the just war theory, that though a terrible thing, violence was sometimes necessary, and in fact the righteous thing to do in certain circumstances, such as self-defense, defending others, especially the weak, or to prevent a greater evil. But it was only ever okay as an absolute last resort. We could debate the ethics of this, but this basically opened the door to quick militarization and the use of military force and violence to force conversions, such as in the case with Charlemagne and the Germanic tribes. But with the rise of the Muslim threat, Christendom armed itself to the teeth. The violence of the crusading forces, ostensibly sent to defend Christendom and to retake Jerusalem in the name of the one true God, would cause ripples that still reverberate today and created centuries of tension and mistrust. Even by 11th century standards, the violence of the Crusaders was shocking. And the irony of the fact that they bore the image of the cross, Cruci Signatus, something that was basically the opposite of violent conquest, seems to have been lost on them. But surely this irony wouldn't be lost on Christians today, right? Surely we wouldn't glory in violence in the 21st century? Ha! If only that was the truth. I recently saw a preacher on Instagram by the name of talk about how he hoped Jerusalem would be invaded, destroyed, and the Al-Aqsa Mosque with the Dome of the Rock pulled down in order to build the third temple to fulfill some prophecy. His rhetoric was violent and aggressive, and the people in the crowd were zealously applauding him. This was very recent, and I was expecting them to start chanting, "God wills it." Unfortunately, maybe we haven't learnt all that much from the Crusades. Next week, we'll be looking at something different, going from a violent period of time where Christians did not act all that great, to another violent period of time where some Christians did act quite well. Next week, we'll be exploring the life of the German pastor Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a preacher who resisted Hitler and the Nazi Party during World War II. Plenty of ethical questions to explore there. This episode was recorded on the traditional lands of the Whadjuk Noongar people. I look forward to exploring more isms and schisms with you.